If you ever had children, you remember there was a time in their early development that I will refer to as the era of the mouth. Remember when they put stuff in their mouth? I mean, everything. They'd find it, and it was their way of exploring life, be it a stone, a toy, a fist, a cockroach, whatever they found, it went in the mouth. Now, putting sand or rocks in your mouth sounds detestable to an adult, but in some cases it would be desirable. Some of the early Greek philosophers taught their students how to articulate words by putting stones in the mouth. There's a particular type of crane that lives in the mountains, the Taurus Mountains of southern Turkey, that attracts the attention of eagles by its cackle. It's a very loud noise that it makes, especially when they fly, so that the more experienced cranes have learned that if you put rocks in the mouth, and the cranes will do this, they'll put rocks in the mouth and fly, and that takes away their tendency to want to cackle so that they won't be lunch for some eagle. They've learned that when you watch your mouth, you might save your life. That's what I'd like to talk to you about this morning in Ecclesiastes chapter 10. It's not just cranes that have a problem with their mouth. There's another creature that does, called a human being. Our mouths can get us into trouble. They can bless, they can help, they can encourage, they can confuse, they can do damage sometimes. Our mouths can be busy, and in their busyness, they can demand attention. In one instance, they might say, so to speak, feed me. And so we have diets to curb that. Other instances, it's what comes out of our mouth. Jesus said, that is what defiles a person, what comes out of the mouth. Things that we say, words that hurt. Now, language is interesting. You can say certain things in English that in America work all right, but if you take them over to England or Scotland or Australia, they don't work well. For instance, one of the American colloquialisms is, what a bummer. And it usually has dude attached to it. What a bummer, dude. You don't want to say that in England or Scotland or Australia, because bummer here means something really bad, a bad turn of events. It means one's backside, rear end in England and Scotland. So especially if you address a crowd, like if you're a preacher, you don't want to say, that was really a bummer. It would offend people. It sends out a wrong message. There was a lady, she was from England. She visited Switzerland where she wanted to attend school. While she was at the school in Switzerland, she met the schoolmaster who gave her a tour of the premises, showed her the different rooms and how it was laid out, where she would be staying. And so she went back home to England to pack up her gear and move to Switzerland. While she was back home packing up her clothes and the stuff that she was going to take to live in Switzerland with, she remembered that the schoolmaster had failed to show her the WC. Where was the WC located in conjunction to her room? Now, in England, a WC is water closet. It means bathroom, restroom. So if you go to England, you'll see WC. That means the restroom. So she writes a letter to the schoolmaster. I didn't see any WC. Where is it? Especially in connection to my room. Well, the schoolmaster in Switzerland wasn't proficient in English. He didn't know what WC meant. He thought about it, asked some of his friends, what's WC? The only thing they could come up with the initials WC, was the West Side Chapel, a little chapel that was on the premises. And so he wrote back this letter to this English gal. Now imagine you're an English woman thinking what WC means in your mind, and you get this letter. My dear madam, I take great pleasure in informing you that the WC is situated 9 miles from the house. In the center of a beautiful grove of pine trees, surrounded by lovely grounds. It's capable of holding 229 people. And it's open on Sundays and Thursdays only. As there are a great number of people expected during the summer months, I suggest you come early. Although usually there's plenty of standing room. This is an unfortunate situation, especially if you're in the habit of going regularly. Miscommunication. It may be of some interest to know that my daughter was married in the WC, and it was there that she met her husband. I can remember the rush there was for seats. There were 10 people to every seat, usually occupied by one. It was wonderful to see the expressions on their faces. You'll be glad to hear that a good number of people bring their lunch and make a day of it. While those who can't afford to go by car arrive just on time. I would especially recommend your ladyship to go on Thursdays when there's a piano accompaniment. The acoustics are excellent, and even the most delicate sounds can be heard everywhere. The newest addition is a bell, donated by a wealthy resident of the district. It rings every time that a person enters. A bazaar is to be held to provide plush seats for all, since the people feel it's long needed. Now, my wife is a rather delicate sort, so she cannot attend regularly. It's been almost a year since she last went, and naturally it pains her very much not to be able to go more often. I shall be delighted to reserve the best seat for you, where you shall be seen by all. Signed, the schoolmaster. Now, he's thinking of a chapel. She's thinking of a restroom. Words can be helpful or confusing and even hurtful. The 10th chapter is a poetic interlude drawing to a conclusion in chapter 11 and finally chapter 12. It's the poetic part of his journal on the meaning of life. As Solomon looks around life, he's tried different things, he's observed different things, and now he, in a poetic fashion, writes about the fool, folly. And he continues the thought that we talked about last week of what folly is and what to avoid. But now in terms of the mouth, what goes into the mouth, what comes out of the mouth. Because the mouth reveals the heart. Out of the abundance of the heart, Jesus said, the overflow of the heart, the mouth will speak. And the fool will show his identity in three ways he misuses his mouth. Babbling, indulging, and maligning. That's the outline. Babbling, your words. Indulging, your appetites. Maligning, your acquaintances. Let's go back to verse 11. That's where the paragraph begins. And he says, a serpent may bite when it is not charmed. The babbler is no different. The words of the wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of fools shall swallow him up. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness. The end of his talk is raving madness. A fool also multiplies words. No man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will be after him? The labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city. This is babbling. A wise man once said, the best way to save face is to keep the bottom portion of it closed. The babbler could use that piece of advice. Speech is generally how we communicate. I say generally because sometimes we communicate by body language. A look on the face, a gesture, communicates volumes. Or sometimes we communicate by sign language. And there are times that emotions run so deep that words can't really adequately express what we want to feel or say. But generally, we use speech. Now, here's the question. How important are the words we choose? Does it really matter what we say? Well, James would say in chapter 3 of his book, oh, you betcha. Because that tongue might be small, but it can start a huge fire. And just like a rudder of a ship is turned by, or a ship is turned by a small member, a rudder, a life is turned by the tongue. And listen to how James puts it. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. In other words, if in your life you can, by discipline, control what you say, it shows that you have discipline in all the areas of your life, because that's the toughest. Now, Solomon had a lot to say about words. I started digging around the writings of Solomon, which are the book of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, which we're reading, and the Song of Solomon, discovered that he used terms like lips, mouth, words, 147 times. That's just his writings. Here he talks about babbling, and he would say in the first two verses that we read that babbling can be destructive in nature. Look at how he puts it. A serpent may bite when it's not charmed. The babbler is no different. So, the biting effect of certain words, phrases, the edge that communication can carry. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of fools shall swallow him up. Words can be said carelessly. We can spew them, and in the spew hurt others. Proverbs 12:18 says, "There is one who speaks like the piercings of a sword." Do you know anybody who is a sharp-tongued individual? Because of whatever has happened in his or her life, there's now this biting edge to every communique that comes forth. Just that little ooh. They're verbal terminators. We're all tempted to do that. We've all done it. How many times have we said something that we think, I'd love to grab that and stuff it back down, but it's too late. You've said it. Damage has been done. Then you move into damage control mode. You know, you say it and you go, oh, well, what I really meant to say was... Yeah, we know what you meant to say. You just said it. There's a publication called Medicine at Work. It's put out by the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, highlighting the importance of words spoken to patients and how that careless speech needs to be watched by nurses, doctors, anesthetists as a person is going under the drug before they go under sleep and anesthesia for surgery. They hear certain things that can bring abject fear to their heart. Here's the article. As the anesthetic is given for surgery, deadly fear may strike the patient when he hears someone say, I'm going to shoot him now. Now, they mean get a hypodermic needle and give medicine. Shoot, a shot. But imagine being a patient. You're going under, okay, I'm going to shoot him. Or hook up the monitor, says the article. Monitor to a drugged patient may sound like monster. Or the doctor may say in disgust, this just isn't my day. How'd you like to hear that as you're going into surgery? It's just in my day. Yeah. CBS ran a special, and I've noticed several other networks have as well, on Karen Carpenter. She was in a group with her brother, Richard Carpenter, the Carpenters. And several years ago, she died unexpectedly at 32 years of age of a sudden heart attack. The heart condition was brought on by an eating disorder known as anorexia nervosa. But the eating disorder, this compulsion to lose weight, was brought on by a remark, a statement made by a reviewer of their songs when the reviewer referred to her as Richard's chubby sister. Those words were biting words. They sunk deep. And she's gone. Look at verse 12. The very end says, the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. So you're not just going to hurt other people if you're a babbler. You're going to hurt yourself eventually. You can get hurt. I might paraphrase it by saying a sharp tongue invites a split lip. You might say certain things and that other person may do something about it, like put a fist where you just spoke. Now, if you go on in verse 13, he continues the thought of babbling to say that this kind of speech has really no content. It's devoid of any meaningful message. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness. The end of his talk is raving madness. I think the thought is this type of person, the babbler, just begins talking. There's no real good premise to begin with. It's a ridiculous premise. It might be brought on by paranoia, delusion, superstition. So the result, the conclusion, is even weirder. Now that's opposed to what Solomon once wrote in the book of Proverbs. In the 12th chapter of that beautiful book, Solomon says, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver. Isn't that picturesque? Word fitly spoken, just the right word at the right time. It's so beautiful, it's framed in silver. Apples of gold in settings of silver. Mark Twain once said, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. Get the message? They're worlds apart. They're related in name only. Lightning, bug, lightning. One is powerful, magnificent. One's a bug. Speech is like that. There are certain words that are said that, okay, technically they're words, they're language, but they're absolutely devoid of any meaningful substantive content. Empty. Many examples could be cited. I can think of profanity as being one of those examples. Profanity. You can't escape it. It's everywhere. Turn on the TV, go to a movie, you'll hear it. Empty words, fill words, four-letter words. For some, it's hard to shake. I hear it in Starbucks. I've even heard it in church. The parking lot would be an interesting place to discover some of those words. I even remember a guy coming up to me one time, shook my hand, dead serious, said, "Hell of a sermon this morning, Pastor. Thank you very much." Now, usually, profanity is associated with humor. And that's why it's prevalent on television. People know that if they say it, like a stand-up comic, they're going to get laughs. Stupid words that stupid people will laugh at.
It's funny.
No, it's not. It's dumb. Don't need to say that. USA Today did a little article. They said researchers have monitored 2 weeks of primetime programming on NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox Network and found that words that were once banned are now heard once every 5 minutes on primetime sitcoms. In 1 year, primetime television will air 23,566 uses of profanity. Now, it goes without saying, but we'll say it anyway. This is not language that is befitting a Christian. It's not. Empty talk doesn't fit with a Christian. Why? Because we represent God. That's why. The Apostle Paul in Colossians said, "Let your speech always be filled with grace, seasoned with salt, that you might know how to answer every man." So that the children of the king should use the language of the court, God's language. There was a guy traveling on an airplane. He was a salesman. Traveling on an airplane. In fact, he was an inebriated salesman traveling on an airplane. In fact, he was an inebriated salesman traveling on an airplane who happened to sit next to Billy Graham. And the guy was loose and he was drinking and he was swearing. And Billy Graham was sitting next to him and he turned to him. Imagine this now. And Billy says, "Are you paid anything for all the swearing you do?" Now, if you're traveling and you're that guy and you know the voice of Billy Graham, how haunting that would be. "Are you paid anything? Whoa." He says, "No, I do it for nothing." And Billy said, "Nothing? Boy, you work cheap. You throw aside your character as a gentleman. You inflict pain on your friends. You break God's commandments. You endanger your own soul all for nothing. You certainly work cheap. Too cheap." Now, I would think that if you're the kind of guy that's waiting for God to speak to you, that would qualify as one of those times. Billy Graham just said that to me. Uh-oh. Solomon continues his thought in the 14th verse. He shows that babbling, by its very nature, is disproportionate to the need. There's just too many words. It just goes on and on. "A fool multiplies words," says Solomon. "No man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will come after him? The labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city." According to those who keep statistics, you speak enough words every day, as do I, to fill a book 50 pages, 50-page booklet. In a year, you will have produced enough verbiage to produce 132 volumes, each with 400 pages. In a lifetime, that's over 3,000 volumes, roughly, with 1,500,000 pages altogether. Words that we speak. Now, some can speak too much. Speech can sometimes be effusive. Too much information, enough. Proverbs 10, verse 19, Solomon writes, "In the multitude of words, sin is not lacking, but he who restrains his lips is wise." There's another proverb, I don't recall exactly which one, but Proverbs, Solomon says, "Even a fool, if he holds his lips, is perceived to be wise." He's just not saying anything. Pondering, pensive. Somebody thinks, that guy's wise. Just because he doesn't say anything. The Lord's Prayer is 56 words. Those are 56 words of very meaningful communication with God. The Gettysburg Address has 266 words. The Ten Commandments, 290-some words, depending on which version you read it in. The Declaration of Independence, right around 300 words. And a recent government order setting the price of cabbage over 26,000 words. Now, I would think you could say it in a lot less than that. Babbling is when the brain and the mouth don't engage at the same time. They're not synced. So that you turn on the hose and just let it run, so to speak. You're talking before you're thinking. And notice in verse 14, no man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what's going to be after him? In other words, this guy's talking so much that nobody can give him any instruction, any direction of what's coming ahead in the future. He's doing all the talking. He's not receiving any instruction. So he'll never know about God's wisdom, God's plan for his life, how relationships ought to work in God's plan. He's doing all the talking. He doesn't even know it says how to go to the city. That's probably an old phrase similar to ours when we speak about people like this. And we say, you know, he doesn't even know enough to come in out of the rain. He hasn't even listened to get directions how to go to town. Now, this is something about the babbler, and if you've ever counseled one, you know that it's absolutely a waste of time because they don't want counsel. They just want to talk, and you just nod and go, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's absolutely a waste of time because they have all the answers. They don't want answers. They want echoes, or they want you to pat them on the back and accommodate what they're coming up with. That's the babbler. Second on the list, where we should watch our mouth, is indulging. Verse 16, woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Because of laziness, the building or the house, maybe referring to the nation, decays. And through idleness of hands, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. Now, I want to unravel that for you. Have you noticed that Solomon speaks a lot about leadership, government, good leaders, bad leaders? He talks about that a lot, even in this book. Now, he returns to that theme, but only as it relates to the mouth. Here are a group of leaders indulging, taking in to their mouths. Notice the words feast, the word drunkenness. Again, feast is used a second time, and then wine. These are all pictures of indulgence. These are people with too much time on their hands and too many resources at their disposal. That's what it's speaking about. Notice it says, princes feast in the morning. Now, he's not getting down on people who eat breakfast. He's talking about feasting, which in those days included drinking wine. These guys, from morning on, are feasting, drinking, eating in excess, drinking in excess. Now, in Hebrew culture, the mornings were always reserved for the affairs of state. No feasts in the morning. You get down to business. You settle problems between people, government issues. Then in the evening, the nobles would get together for a feast. But these guys start early in the morning, carry it through the day. Isaiah spoke about officials in his time like that. Isaiah chapter 5, woe to those who rise early in the morning that they might follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night, until wine inflames them. Woe to you, mighty men at drinking wine. Gluttony and drunkenness, which are part of abundance, can be the downfall of a person, a family, a nation. This week, I was thinking about this, and I remembered one time reading a book by Francis Schaeffer called How Should We Then Live? Subtitled, The Rise and Decline of Western Civilization. And I recall him speaking about Rome and how Rome fell, the different stages in the latter part of the Roman Empire. And I thought, I got to find that. So I found it, I dug it up, and I want to read this paragraph to you because it sounds hauntingly contemporary. Here it is, speaking about the latter part of the Roman Empire. As the empire ground down, the decadent Romans were given to a thirst for violence and gratification of the senses. This is especially evident in their rampant sexuality. For example, in Pompeii, the phallus cult was strong, Statues and paintings of exaggerated sexuality adorned the houses of the more affluent. Sexual representations were unabashedly blatant. Now just think in terms of what's being allowed in movies that wasn't allowed a few years ago. He continues, apathy was a chief mark of the late empire. One of the ways the apathy showed itself was a lack of creativity in the arts. Officially sponsored art was decadent and music was increasingly bombastic. Even the portraits on the coins was marked by the predominant apathy of the culture. As the Roman economy slumped lower and lower, burdened with an aggravated inflation and costly government, authoritarianism increased to counter apathy. Listen to his concluding remarks. Rome did not fall because of external forces such as the invasion of the barbarians. Rome had no sufficient inward base, and Rome gradually became a ruin. Did you notice that word gradually? It starts with abundance, immorality, apathy, corrupt government. Now, in line with that, look at verse 18. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. Picture yourself living in a home. You don't do anything to the house. Now, if you want a house to decay, you don't have to do anything. You just don't do anything. Over time, naturally, that edifice will decay. There'll be leaks in the roof, holes in the wall. Things will wear out. So that, here's the picture. If you live all of your life to indulge yourself rather than fix what's around you, there will be decay. Nothing wrong with a feast. Nothing wrong with having fun. Nothing wrong with having money. The point here is living life for oneself. Self-indulgence. If you live your life to take in rather than to give out, it will destroy you. A graphic picture of this, and those traveling with us to Israel in a couple months, you'll see it for yourself. The difference between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. The Sea of Galilee up north is green, verdant, beautiful. The Dead Sea is pretty ugly, pretty dead. 25% salt solution. And there's a reason for that. The Sea of Galilee has an inlet and an outlet. The Dead Sea has an inlet only, no outlet. It's dead. People are like that. If they take in and they bless others, they give out. There's life around them. But if they live just to indulge and take in, it's ruinous. It's wrong. Finally, there is maligning that Solomon mentions. That is slander, gossip. Verse 20, do not curse the king. Now, it's interesting that Solomon was the king when he wrote this. Of course, it still is Bible. It's scripture, so we want to read it as such. Don't curse the king even in your thought. Do not curse the rich even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. In those days, officials were worried about loose talk. Because loose talk, rumors can spread, they can get fueled, they can get blown out of proportion, and a possible insurrection might occur, a rebellion. So government officials were really concerned about what the people were saying, those vocal movements, cursing the king. In fact, I've read some stories where kings went incognito among the people. They put on peasants' robes just to listen to what people were saying about the king. Get an idea, flavor. If you are apt to do this with government, that's the context here, cursing the king, the rich, those in rulership. If you're apt to do that with the king, you're apt to do that in other areas of your life. If you're a complainer and a slanderer with this area, chances are that sort of marks your life. I did a little study this week. I was reading through Proverbs because Solomon had so much to say about this in that book. And I discovered a list in chapter 6 of Proverbs. And the reason it fascinated me, it's a list of the things God hates. Which is pretty interesting. If you have in the Bible a list and God says, let me just tell you up front what I hate, I think it's worth paying attention to. This is what I discovered. 3 out of the 7 things that God hates all have to do with the misuse of the mouth. And the last one on the list is one who sows discord among the brethren. God hates that. Sowing discord, disharmony, saying something that would disrupt a relationship, would sever two people or a group of people. Sowing discord is something God hates. Now, it begins silently in your thought, verse 20. You think it. You entertain it. You're concerned about it. Eventually, that concern will be verbal. You'll tell it to a significant other, a friend. But that has a way of going a lot more places. You're concerned, you tell it to someone. That person is concerned, tells it to a significant other. Pretty soon, since everybody has a significant someone, everybody knows. Sometimes these things show up as prayer requests. They're carefully, cleverly covered and nicely packaged. So you're in a little prayer group. You're with your friends and somebody brings up this prayer. Lord, I just pray that you'd help Skip. You know he's a real jerk, Lord. You know it, and I know it. Lord, help him. Really help him, Lord, with this. Now, somebody in your prayer group's going to... He is? I didn't know that. I mean, I had suspicions that he was. But now I know for sure that he is. Oh, how I'm so burdened. I got to share this burden with somebody else. All kidding aside, there was a flower shop in West Virginia run by a guy named Bill Graiolas. He's 41 years old, went on a diet, lost a lot of weight. He was doing good until a rumor spread around that little West Virginia town that he had the AIDS virus because he had lost so much weight. He was looking good, feeling good, but they said he's got AIDS. He didn't. Graffiti appeared on the walls. Threats came to him. Customers that had been with him 20 years started dropping off. He denied it. Rumors persisted. He decided, I'm giving up the diet. I'll gain weight. He went and had a blood test to show that he was not with the virus. He posted the results of the blood test on the window of the flower shop. The rumor still persisted. Rocks went through his window, bricks, his van, the delivery van was trashed, all because of a vicious rumor. That's how destructive it can be. Now, I've discovered the problem isn't only with open mouths, it's with so many open ears willing to receive what is said. That's the thought behind the idea of this verse. A bird of the air may carry your voice. Ever heard the saying when somebody says, how'd you find that out? A little bird told me. This is where it originates. You tell someone, they tell somebody else, they tell somebody else, and it comes around. Because there's so many open ears. I suggest that if somebody brings you an evil report about somebody else, that you ask a series of questions to that person. Number one, when they come to you, say, why are you telling me? There's a lot of people. Why have you come to me? Maybe it's anger, maybe it's jealousy. A second question, where'd you get your information? What are your sources? How do you know? Who told you? Well, I don't want to reveal my sources, confidential. Well, then you have no business talking to me. A third question, have you gone directly to those involved? Isn't that what the Bible says to do? Go to your brother first? Well, no, I didn't go to my... You're the pastor. I've come to you. You're supposed to go to him. That's your job. No, we're personally to go to that person. Then ask them this question. Have you personally checked this out? Have you checked the facts? Do you know this is true? No, but a good friend of mine, listen, he's a reliable source. No, have you checked them out yourself? You know, facts can grow over time. They just kind of, it's like fish stories. They get bigger every time it's told. Finally, ask this question, and I usually ask this when anybody brings me an evil report about somebody. I say, can I quote you on that? What do you mean, quote me? Yeah, well, you told me, so I'm going to quote, you're my source. No, I don't want to be involved. You are involved. You just told me. Can I quote you? No. Well, what's your name? Not going to tell you. But I know what you look like. Here's the bottom line. We should be living our lives asking God to control our tongue. James said it. No man can control the tongue. So if you go home, stick it out in the mirror and go, you're mine. You're under my control. It won't work. Only God, the Holy Spirit, can control the tongue. And He wants to do it. He wants to do it. Surrender your body as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your reasonable service. That includes the mouth. We want to live our lives in such a way so that at the end of our lives, we don't end up like Arabella Young, who when she was buried on her tombstone in England, it reads, beneath this stone, a lump of clay, lies Arabella Young, who on the 24th of May began to hold her tongue. It wasn't until that gal died that the mouth was under control. Doesn't have to be that way. Shouldn't be that way for a believer.